Please.
We are here in the matter of Merit Incentives LLC versus the District Court, Bumble and Bumble, case number 56313. We have Mr. Bice on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. Humanowski on behalf of the real party in interest. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for my rebuttal.
Very well.
Members of the Court, the issue presented by our petition is whether the state of Nevada is going to have a standard of ethical conduct that is below that of any other jurisdiction, state or federal, for lawyers that come into possession of an opponent's confidential and privileged information under circumstances that would alert any person, let alone a highly experienced lawyer, as to the highly privileged and confidential nature of those documents. In answering that question, the record shows us the following facts that are not subject to legitimate dispute. Bumble and Bumble sued Merit's Incentives on February 22 of 2008. On July 28 of that same year, an individual that worked for a related company, Fidel Express, by the name of Muhammad Izam Abay Hadir, although I'm quite sure I have not pronounced that properly, was fired by Cadeau. At the time of his termination, he was engaged in espionage against the company and had stolen extensive numbers of documents. He was in fact charged with, arrested, and made bail on a claim of extortion, and it is believed that he fled the country to the country of Lebanon, which was, as I understand it from the record, his home.
Is there any evidence in the record that either Mr. Mobry or his client was aware of the order entered against that individual?
Yes, there is a letter in the record dated, and I believe it is dated April 3rd of 2009, from Mr. Mobry as counsel for Bumble to his opposing counsel, I believe it was Lisa Anderson, and it's in the record, that talked about the fact this was a discovery dispute over a subpoena that they had issued to Cadeau. And in that letter, he quotes extensively from the affidavit signed by Ramon Desage that was submitted to the district court in order to secure the very injunction that we are talking about here. And we also have in the record the uncontroverted affidavit of Lance Coburn, who was counsel at the time for the petitioners, to the effect that he had spoken to Mr. Mobry. Mr. Mobry had confirmed to Mr. Coburn the fact that he was well aware and that they had conducted an extensive review of the other litigation in which Ramon Desage was involved. So the answer to that is yes. Any reasonable person knew, obviously, because they were quoting the letter of the affidavit seeking the injunction, that something had happened in that case. You couple that with the fact that Mr. Mobry had, in fact, sort of bragged to Mr. Coburn about the fact that they had dug up all of this information on Mr. Coburn's clients. To have a simple denial that says, well, we didn't know about the injunction, flies in the face of their own correspondence confirming that they were well aware of that litigation. We also know that what happened after that letter came is that in September, and I believe it is September 24, a disk was received by Bumble and Bumble with specific instructions that disk be sent to its counsel, John Mobry. On that disk, and I believe, although I will acknowledge I have not reviewed, I did not put the disk in my computer because as I understand that disk, it tended to corrupt other people's computers. It's my understanding from the record that the first document on that disk is an introductory letter entitled, or that begins, "Hi John," that then goes into detail and lays out the harm that the alleged anonymous provider of this disk intended to cause to Cadeau as well as Mr. Desage. It lays out the plan to harm them. It emphasizes that the documents are extremely sensitive and to make sure that Mr. Mobry did not use them until the sender and he talked. It concludes that, "Please try to hide my name." And as well as, if there is any difficulty in understanding the documents, to please let me know. The disk was purportedly corrupted from its inception. Did they alert their opponent when they received the disk? No. What they did is they obviously looked at the disk, and I believe it is on October the 15th, they do a standard 16.1 supplemental disclosure of additional documents. additional documents from the case. In other words, this disc is treated as though it is simply another piece of ordinary documents that we all produce in the ordinary course of business. My client, the petitioners, were in the process of switching counsel at that moment in time, and there was some discussion back and forth about to whom the supplemental disclosures should have been given. 4 days later, an additional supplemental disclosure was given. This time, again, just producing the disc, which they say was corrupted. They didn't tell anyone that it was corrupted and that it was inaccessible. This time, producing the disc and a stack of documents, which were some of the documents that purportedly came from the disc. So over the course of about a month, if their version of that the disc was corrupted when they received it was accurate, they obviously got someone to be able to access the documents. And they produced them in the ordinary course as discovery. We know that the following did not happen. There was no attempt to bring these documents specifically to the attention of their opponent. There was no attempt to highlight to the opponent the nature of the documents and how the documents had been received and the nature in which the documents had been received. What then happened is about a month, if I recall correctly, about a month after that supplemental production, during that month's time, obviously, or actually 2 months' time since they'd had the disc, someone went through that disc with a fine-tooth comb. And how do we know that that happened? Because they issued a request for production of documents covering every single document on that disc, except for three. Every document, 500 different documents are identified in this list of requests for production of documents. They went into subfiles in the request for production and broke down the individual entries in the subfiles. Three documents are omitted from that request. Which ones were they? Number one, the letter that says, "Hi, John." Number two, the draft affidavit that even Judge Denton acknowledges was attorney-client privilege. And number three, the litigation strategy memo that has at its top in large, bold letters, attorney-client privilege, which was the communication from in-house counsel to Mr. Ferrario and Lisa Anderson concerning his view of many of the allegations in the case, including a section entitled analysis. Those are the only three documents, oddly, that didn't merit a document production request. So we know the following. Somebody inside that firm at Fenimore Craig looked at every one of them and decided, these ones, we don't want to ask any follow-up about these three. If you really didn't know who it was that sent you the documents, and you got this, "Hi, John," wouldn't you have conducted discovery from your opponent saying, "Do you know who this person is?" Of course you would have. And if you really thought you were supposed to possess these documents and that you were entitled to possess them, wouldn't a diligent lawyer do discovery on them? Of course they would. In fact, if we are to accept Mr. Hemanowski's arguments in this case, a lawyer is duty-bound and ethically obligated to pursue, to review every document that is in the file and understand the nature of it and how it can be used to best benefit their client. Well, let's apply that standard. What happened here? Obviously, someone inside Fenimore Craig reviewed those documents, and it was someone with some level of sophistication because they obviously decided we don't want to ask follow-up questions about those three documents. That brings us to what is the law when that happens? So these documents then floated around for a period of time, and there can be no dispute that Mr. Mowbray knew Muhammad's name. He actually, as the record shows, he spelled it in the middle of a deposition and spelled it correctly. I can't even pronounce it correctly, let alone spell it. But nonetheless, we know he knew the name because it was in the affidavit of Ramon Desage that he specifically quoted in his letter months before he had received the disc. So that brings us to, well, what is the law when you come into possession of documents that you know are privileged and that you know you were not supposed to have? Court after court, and I don't need to belabor the point, say the following. Stop, alert your opponent, await instructions, and if you can't resolve it, let the court decide. It is that simple. It's not a complicated process to understand. It could have easily been followed here, and this entire dispute could have been avoided. I'm not here to tell you that there are whistleblowers out there and that whistleblowing isn't sometimes legitimate in cases or in the political process in general, because it is. But the rule that the courts have laid down protects the legitimate whistleblower, because if the whistleblower provides documents to an opponent, the court gets to decide whether in advance, before you have gone through them, whether or not you are entitled to have them. That did not happen here, and that did not happen for one reason and one reason only, because the opponents wanted to use them, and so they just treated them like ordinary responses so that it would not come to anyone's attention. Now, there's been much reference made throughout the briefing about 4.4b of the Rules of Professional Responsibility and whether it applies here and whether it doesn't. Obviously, it doesn't by its terms, because it talks about inadvertent disclosure. But as the courts make note, because most jurisdictions have a similar 4.4b, that's the minimum standard to be applied when you get a document inadvertently. In other words, your opponent is somewhat responsible for you having the document, and even under those circumstances, you are required to promptly notify your opponent. Let's apply that standard to what happened here. Assume for the sake of argument that I send inadvertently an attorney-client memorandum, confidential, to my opponent. Does it satisfy 4.4b for my opponent to stick it in a stack of 16.1 documents that they're doing in their next supplemental production and send it back to me and identify on it? Well, I've produced it. And now I've satisfied that ethical obligation? Not so. And if you were to adopt the position that they are taking, that's exactly what's going to happen with every inadvertent disclosure now. Now they're going to be set, they're going to be slipped into 16.1 productions, and they're just going to be produced, and they're going to say, hey, we told you. You're obligated to search through everything in 16.1 we produce and disclose it. I do not want to ignore, even though I'm clearly running out of time, this argument about waiver. This reminds me of my children, what they tell me when I catch them doing something that they weren't supposed to. Had you been watching me a little more carefully, Dad, it wouldn't have happened. So therefore, it's really your fault. Waiver requires the intentional relinquishment of a known right. You can't know about something when the other side is hiding the ball from you. And also, the mere passage of time, as this court knows, does not constitute a waiver. Our conduct has to be so inconsistent with our rights as to lead a reasonable person to believe that we had abandoned the rights, the privilege. They knew we hadn't abandoned the privilege, because if they really thought that we had abandoned it, they would have conducted discovery on those two critical documents. They kept those two critical documents out of their requests for one reason and one reason only. They didn't want to highlight them to the petitioner, and they didn't want petitioner's counsel to know about it, because then the entire thing would have been brought to the district court's attention with plenty of time to address it. I want to reserve the rest of my time if you don't have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bice.
Thank you.
Mr. Himanowski.
Thank you. Justices, the standard of review is manifest abuse of discretion. You've seen the detailed decision that Judge Denton rendered after he heard the matter. It's very difficult to see how that standard can even be invoked here in the face of the effort that he took, a matter ignored by counsel. Let's go back briefly over what really happened. Facts in the record. Mr. Mowbray receives this package from his client, who received it from somebody. Was it this Muhammad person? Perhaps. We don't know. There's no evidence in the record as to who it really came from. The documents come in a disk, which Mr. Mowbray noted was scratched. Actually, Mr. Mowbray didn't note it. He was in hospital. Somebody else took care of it for him. After getting the disk and finding out what they had, they promptly sent it to the Glazer firm, first asking the two firms that were changing, Rothschild or Fox Rothschild and Glazer, who should I send it to? Corey Eschweiler, a partner at the Glazer firm, says, send it to me. We did. And when we sent it to him, it was a very short 16.1 supplement of three parts, three paragraphs, one of which said, disk received by Bumble and Bumble on September 24th, 2009, from an unidentified source. Page number attached here too. Footnote, the original disk was scratched, and as a result, some of the information on the disk appears to be inaccessible. They receive it. No word from Mr. Eschweiler. By the way, did you see his affidavit? No, you didn't. There's no affidavit from Mr. Eschweiler, who handles all of this for the Glazer firm. Where's his affidavit? Where's Corey Eschweiler? Shortly thereafter, we sent another 16-1 supplement. Reviewed the disc again. Here's a copy of the disc. Here's a copy of the envelope it came in. And the envelope, as you recall from the record, is the one that shows it came from Lebanon. Highly confidential. Send it to John Mowbray. All of that right on the envelope, which we sent to them on October 19th. And what do they do? Nothing. Nothing. So, we take the documents from the disc, 503 documents, and we send them all to them and ask them to produce their original copy so we can authenticate them. And what does Mr. Eschweiler do? He says, I need more time. We give him more time. And in January, he files his response. And this is, by the way, to the point where they're saying they didn't know what they had. Here's what he said in his response. From the appendix at page 352, responding to, excuse me, I grabbed this thing so quickly, I grabbed the wrong page. It's appendix page 400. And the response from Mr. Eschweiler, whose affidavit we don't have, said, defendant objects to this request on the grounds that it seeks information and documents already in Bubble's possession, on the grounds that it is overbroad and unduly burdensome, on the grounds that it seeks information protected by the attorney-client or the attorney-work product privilege, on the grounds that many of the documents on the disc are corrupted and will not open, and on the grounds that many of the documents on the disc, excuse me, and on the grounds that it is vague and ambiguous in that Bumble has not identified the source of the disc. Tell me they didn't know what was here. Where's Corey Eschweiler's affidavit? Where's Corey? How does he explain what he knew, what he did, what he didn't do? Of course there's a waiver here. Of all those documents, 503 documents, there were two, only two, as to which they later claimed a privilege. Now, Judge Denton said one of them was privileged, the other was not. Frankly, from our point of view, we don't care. These are not documents we're interested in using one way or another. We're interested in the shipping documents and the records that show the diversion by the defendant of our product. We're interested in the documents that they should have produced, disclosing all the product that they had diverted improperly and didn't produce until the disc came along. That's what we're interested in. And those are not privileged documents. You know, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that these documents were misappropriated. We don't know if these were found by this Mohammed person. We don't know if somebody found them dumpster diving. We have no idea where they came from because there's no evidence. They don't even have an affidavit from somebody who said, I searched our company computer records and I can see that each of these documents came from a confidential folder, someplace where we treated them as trade secrets. None of that's here. We're supposed to take it all apparently on blind faith or on argument, but there's no evidence to support that. You know, the policy that counsel referred to, he said, are you going to have a lower standard than any other jurisdiction in the country? As though the standard he identified was uniform. Far from it. Far, far from it. Let me tell you what the actual history of this whole issue on what do you do is. In 1992, there was no rule addressing inadvertent production of documents. A question was posed to the American Bar Association Committee on Ethics. What do we do if we get an inadvertently produced document? They looked at the question, they said there is no rule, and technically our brief is only to interpret the rules, but we'll interpret the preamble to the rules as being applicable, and here's what we think you should do. If you get an inadvertently produced document, you should stop reading it, notify the other side, and abide by their instructions. And that became official opinion 92-368. 2 years later, 1994, someone said to them, oh, what do I do if I get documents from an unidentified source, some of which may be privileged? And in both cases, they were talking about privileged documents. They issued a new opinion in 94 and said, we think you follow the same policy as what we described in 92-368. And that second policy was put forward in 94-382. That's where things go after 94. And some states, like New Jersey, and jurisdiction like the District of Columbia, adopted that by rule. That's what you should do. That underlay some of the cases like the Maldonado case that counsel cited in their briefs. But then came Ethics 2000, the ADA effort to rewrite the ethic rules. They met in the full House of Delegates, not the Ethics Commission, and they adopted the new rules in 2002. And those new rules included 4.4b, just as we adopted it. All it says is you get inadvertent production of documents, you notify the other side. It's up to them then to take action. That's what the ABA said. That's what many states, including us, adopted. Now we go back to the Ethics Commission. With unusual speed for them, in 1995, they revisited that first opinion and said, whoops, now that Rule 4.4b has been adopted, our opinion no longer matters. We're withdrawing that opinion. Next year, in 1996, they withdrew their second opinion, having to do with documents from third-party sources. So by the end of 2006, they have withdrawn from the field, and the field is governed now by Rule 4.4b. The question then becomes, does 4.4b apply when you have a production by a third party? Because there's a question. The way 4.4b was written, it says, you know, talks about inadvertent production. We've always interpreted that in many cases as meaning like the lawyer producing documents in discovery accidentally includes a privileged document. In the federal rule, you know, you have the right to claw it back. And under our rule 4.4b, if that happened, there would be an argument for the attorney to then go to the court if they couldn't reach accommodation with the attorney and say, I need it back. It shouldn't have been produced. What do you do with the situation involving documents produced from third parties? Contrary to what counsel has said, many states have exactly the rule we have, 4.4b. Many states have provisions that if you get documents from third parties that are privileged, bear in mind, almost all these cases turn on them being privileged documents, that your duty is to notify the other side. It's up to them then to decide what to do. The most recent case on that topic is the Chamberlain case, which I provided to the court by a supplement. This is a November 2010 case. The issue in this case involved disclosure of privileged and confidential documents which counsel got from a former employee of the other party. And in that case, they sat on the documents for a year. And that's a big feature in many of these cases, as you'll see if you look at the Maldonado case, the attorney sat on him for 3 years, and Burr Hill, he sat on him for 18 months. It wasn't a prompt notification as we had in our case. In any event, the court went on to say this. The court notes the withdrawal of ABA formal opinion 94-382, and then said, many courts, went on to discuss the standard of Rule 4.4b, and said, many courts, this court included, fail to see why the same duty to disclose should cease where confidential documents are sent intentionally without permission. And they cited the Burt Hill case on which counsel's brief has relied. If anything, the duty to disclose should be stricter when a party obtained the documents outside legitimate discovery procedures. In other words, Chamberlain case tells us notification under 4.4b is exactly what we should do in a case like this and exactly what we did do. Imagine if you would, well, let's put it this way. The most expensive part of civil litigation, discovery. Painful and difficult thing to go through often. We encourage and should independent investigation. We encourage people to go forward with informal discovery because it's a lot cheaper. But we impose upon them a duty. If I go out and discover something, I'm required to supplement my discovery responses by 16.1 or under 26. I've got to tell somebody I found a new witness. I found new documents. I'm required to produce them to them. Under the precedent of this course in the Palmer case, Palmer versus Pioneer, where we adopted the standard en banc that said, we're going to use the managing speaking agent test for who I can talk to on the other side. We can talk to any employee on the other side who's not a managing speaking agent. So Mr. Mowbray, for example, if this logistic engineer were still working for Desage, could have interviewed me. But if he did, he had the duty to supplement his discovery responses. I've identified a witness, I've seen documents, whatever it may be. If he goes out and finds documents in court records or wherever you find your investigation takes you, the duty is to supplement the response, to tell them. We did. We told them promptly within the meaning of the rule. We told them again under the rule. They acknowledged, which Mr. Bice does not, that they had received the information. They acknowledged that we had it. They acknowledged the documents came from the disk. Mr. Eschweiler, the absent Mr. Eschweiler, acknowledged all of that. And then 4 months later, on the eve of trial, suddenly the Glazer firm is shocked to hear we have the disk. How can that be? All of this was explored at great length, of course, in front of Judge Denton. It was briefed extensively. The affidavits are there. Some of the arguments, frankly, were, it was inappropriate for the Glazer firm to accuse Mr. Mowbray of being a liar. That's not how we practice in Nevada. That was wrong. Judge Denton took pains to review that in his decision. John Mowbray did everything that was appropriate for a lawyer to do in like circumstances, and it is, in fact, what we should expect any lawyer to do. If you receive information that you believe is privileged, you are on a duty to promptly notify the other side. It's not just enough, by the way, in my view, to simply say, I've got some stuff you'd be interested in. No, you should do exactly what Mr. Mowbray did, what wasn't done in the Virgil case. We gave him an exact copy of what we got, including the details of how and where we got it, so that he could assess what to do. They chose to do nothing. And then 8 months later, they chose to come forward and call Mr. Mowbray a liar. And that's wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Humanowski. Mr. Bice.
My eloquent colleague says that 4.4b is satisfied by simply 16.1. There's nothing beyond 16.1, which is the bare minimum disclosure requirements that are ever required. So,
can you consider that a notification?
I don't believe so. Why? Mr. Perigary, because if that were what was contemplated, there would be no need for a separate notification requirement in 4.4b. 4.4b is talking about inadvertent disclosures. And I actually agree with him on the Chamberlain case that he quotes. The court correctly says the standard is higher when it's not an inadvertent disclosure, when you've gotten the documents from somebody else. It is not enough when you are in possession of privileged documents to simply say, well, I've attached them in a 16.1 disclosure.
Where does it say in the rule that that's insufficient?
Because
or inadequate notification.
The purpose of the rule, Your Honor, again, is we change that rule to simply say now you don't have to stop and you don't have to go to the court. The opposing side does. But how do they do that if they don't know exactly what you've given them promptly? Their standard is we can, if that is the standard that's going to be implied in this court, I can guarantee you we're going to invite all sorts of mischief now. In this day and age, with data is so transferable and can be obtained by thumb drives, we're now going to endorse the standard that if you obtain an attorney-client memo, a confidential, undisputed confidential memorandum, all you have to do now to satisfy your obligations under 4.4b is stick it in a stack of documents under 16.1, treat it as an ordinary disclosure, nothing special about it, and you produce it to the other side. And if they don't catch it, then that's their fault.
So what should the rule say? Should we be more specific about what constitutes an adequate notification?
It's not a function of the rule. It's just a function of Mr. Humanowski acts as though because 4.4b deals with inadvertent documents, there are no other standards that apply to lawyers. And the ABA has issued a formal opinion and has said exactly that is not true. These rules do not set the universe of ethical conduct by lawyers. And in fact, the cases that we have cited in our briefs, including the Chamberlain matter that he has correctly supplemented to the court, specifically say the standard is higher when you get these documents from in the circumstances in which you secured them.
Mr. Bice, if in fact we acknowledge the position that you are suggesting we take here and require something more than a 16.1 supplementation, how then do you respond with the specific facts of this case wherein the response to request for production seemed to acknowledge notice, awareness, in fact, the actual possession of the materials that you're claiming you had no notice of?
I don't believe that it does read that way. What it reads is that they were aware of a disk. And as the document itself, those were standard, as you can see, everybody lists an objection, grounds of attorney-client privilege, work product. Those are standard objections that are raised in all responses to the extent that the scope of discovery could encompass them. There was no acknowledgement in that response that we knew that you had specific attorney-client documents in your possession.
Mr. Bice, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your
thought. And in fact, again, Justice Sotomayor, they went through that disk in great detail and didn't. If they thought that there was a waiver here and they thought it was legitimate and that they were supposed to possess those documents, they would have asked discovery about them. But they omitted those two documents from their request. Why? Because they didn't want to highlight it. And the whole point of 4.4b is to highlight it so that the opposing side is on notice, can act promptly, and go to the court and get a resolution of it. There is nothing that stopped John Mowbray or whoever it was in his office from sending a letter, picking up the phone, and saying, this is what I've got. I'm going to look at it. If you claim I can't and I can't use this stuff, you better do something about it. Or a letter to that effect. A 16.1 disclosure does not cut it.
If I may ask a question, I have two questions for you,
yes,
Mr. Bice. I can understand your argument that some 16.1 disclosures might not adequately draw appropriate attention to privileged documentation. But isn't the means of communicating the inadvertent disclosure part of the entire analysis that the district court should evaluate when deciding whether there's been compliance with the requirement of notice?
Yes.
I mean, you argue it could have been by phone, it could have been by letter. Mr. Mowbray chose a 16.1 disclosure. In this case, he maintains in this matter that it was prominent enough to bring attention to your client and at least to your client's counsel. So isn't the means of notice really something that the trial judge evaluates when deciding whether the rule's been complied with?
Well, obviously the means of the disclosure.
I mean, if, for example, this had been a situation where the 16.1 disclosure contains 50 pages, and this is found on page 49, one claims that it's therefore inconspicuous, it would seem like the point might be easier to understand. But I'm not sure I understand the difference between the disclosure in this case and a phone call.
The disclosure in this case, again, we have circumstances in this case where the case is being transitioned to a new counsel.
Mm-hmm.
To a new counsel who was new to the case, was not privy to all of what had transpired in the case to this point. The case is being transferred. The disk is corrupted. It's inaccessible in many respects. Mr. Coburn, I believe his affidavit testified that it crashed his computer multiple times when he sought to access the disk. They had even done a subsequent disclosure producing some of the disk, some of the documents off the disk. They didn't identify that, by the way, as a partial disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they copy in that supplemental disclosure on the 19th, 4 days later, why weren't the attorney-client documents in that disclosure?
I guess the second question I'd like to pose, I guess you would agree with me that the district court can evaluate the means of disclosure in making a determination as to whether or not it's been adequately brought to the attention.
It was adequate, yes. The district court obviously under 4.4B, which I agree applies by analogy. It obviously doesn't apply by its own terms. But right. The purpose and spirit of 4.4B is to do that, is to make sure that you promptly notify your opponent.
Okay. And so you don't dispute that the Mowbray firm promptly notified. The dispute is the manner in which they did so.
I dispute that they promptly notified them of what okay. they had. They did within a month a 16.1 disclosure, which I would question whether or not that was prompt within 30 days if you in fact knew you had attorney-client information.
Prompt or sufficient.
Right. And what okay. and what we have well, here
I guess that I leads to my second question then.
Yes, Joseph.
Are you maintaining that the insufficiency of the disclosure, the inadequacy of the disclosure, was the cause of your client's, of this counsel's inaction
yes.
for 7 months?
Yes. Then I don't think.
Where's his affidavit that says that?
Your Honor, I don't think that there's. They did not submit an affidavit from Mr. Eschweiler in this matter. Just like Mr. Mowbray's affidavit is silent about when he was receiving these calls from this anonymous person, He has very detailed billing records that would have revealed that, but he, of course, didn't
well,
want to.
Well, we can go back and forth on that. But I guess to fulfill the point of the rule, though,
yes.
that this panel is being asked to consider what should the state of the law be. Unlike the characterization you gave about your child, this is a bit different to me. When a lawyer is notified, whether it's through a weak 16.1 disclosure, as you maintain, that they got some envelope from Lebanon, from an unknown source, and it's a disc and it's corrupt, is it really appropriate for the lawyer to sit on their hands and do nothing for 7 months?
I don't believe, Your Honor.
Where's the heightened attention to this?
I'm not going to deny that I would hope that I would have seen it and that I would have caught it and that I would have acted more promptly. I would hope that we would, I'm sure we all feel that we would hope that we would do so. But I do know this. That if any of us had received a specific notice, this is what I got, this is how I got it, and by the way, the first document on it, which they of course omitted from their subsequent mm-hmm. disclosure, told the story. And they knew it, and they had they wanted to bring this to our attention, they would have done so. They would have brought it to our attention. They would have specifically said, this is what we got. Included in this is obviously attorney-client protected information. And the question is, what do you do with it?
I guess my point is this. I think the ethical rules demand prompt disclosure in these circumstances. I think the ethical rules also demand prompt response in these circumstances.
And I share your concern on that point, but I would note that obviously it's a lot easier to give a prompt response when the disclosure is
true.
Thorough.
I understand.
And forthright.
I appreciate that.
I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Vice, Mr. Humanowski. This case will stand submitted. Court is in recess.
All rise.